Some folk seem to find it odd that people grow from tiny cells. Pathetic those who think of God and still drop coins in wishing wells. There we are. That was my literary output as an 18-year-old. But it's some ways some of my contempt for Christian belief, and I guess some of the contempt expressed by people like Dawkins and Hawking and others, the idea that if you still believed in God, well, that was a superstition of the kind that is that throws money into a well and hopes for a better day tomorrow with a wish. It was irrational, it was superstitious, it was outdated. And presumably it must be that people who believe in those kind of things just don't understand basic biology. I mean, yeah, people used to think that God made it rain, but now we understand the water cycle. People used to think that God made people ill and then we discovered bacteria. Surely it's time to throw away these superstitions and grow up. That's certainly the terms that Richard Dawkins describes it as. He compares belief in Jesus, belief in God, to belief in the tooth fairy. Something that's okay as a child, but something we better hurry to grow out of as an adult. Science and Christianity, must we choose? I would have said yes. But quite soon after writing that poem, my life turned upside down. I became a follower of the Lord Jesus. It was the end of quite a difficult period. I'd met some Christian friends at university, and their lives had really intrigued and impressed me. The way that they lived, the way that they treated one another, I'd found very attractive. But I wasn't irrational about it. I didn't think just because these Christians were nice, they must be right. But it did intrigue me enough to want to know why. What made them tick like this? And especially because some of them were quite intelligent people. What made them believe these things? And I began to investigate Christianity. I began to look at the person of Jesus. And to cut a long story short, I became convinced it was true. And my life turned upside down. I didn't write any more poems to express my new position. But I did become a Christian. And Jesus became the most important figure in my life. And yet I continued to do my studies in science. I finished my degree and went on to do a PhD in neuroscience afterwards. Now, I wasn't the world's greatest scientist, but I managed to do science with my new belief in Jesus. And if anything, I found the science more exciting. So my particular PhD research was in the mechanisms in the brain by which we compare the signal from the left ear with the signal from the right ear. And I won't say any more about that unless you're an insomniac, but you can ask me afterwards. But some of the, suffice it to say that some of the processes in the human brain and in the human ear are quite extraordinary in their complexity. And as a Christian, I was able to say, what an amazing God who has made these things. Now you might think that a very naive position, but in fact, many of the great scientists of the past had exactly that approach to their studies of science. Maybe you recognise some of these names, people like Michael Faraday, who discovered electricity, Isaac Newton, who formulated his theories of gravitation, most famously Louis Pasteur, who discovered the microbe, Charles Babbage, who built the first mechanical computer that you can see a replica of in the Science Museum, Johannes Kepler, who did work on interplanetary motions, Robert Boyle, who came up with those annoying Boyle's gas laws that you had to learn if you did A-level chemistry, all of them scientists and committed Christians. In fact, arguably, modern science came about because of the belief that those early scientists had in God. Listen to an early historian of science. He says, man became scientific because he looked for law in nature. And he looked for law in nature because he believed in a lawgiver. In other words, the stimulus for science back in the 16th, 17th centuries was the conviction that this world is not random, but has been carefully ordered and designed. And because of that conviction that there was a creator, a lawgiver, people set about trying to understand the universe that God had made. They set about trying to describe it, to formulate it, to investigate it scientifically. So science was never an atheistic discipline at the start at least. Now you might say, oh, of course we've grown up now, we understand more than people like Michael Faraday and Charles Babbage knew. And as we've become more sophisticated, we've become less Christian. Again, I wonder whether that's necessarily the case. I wasn't a great scientist myself, but there were those in the University of Cambridge who were great scientists, who I could meet on church on a Sunday. And their investigation of scientific things, I remember the professor of geophysics at the university was a Christian. One of my biochemistry lecturers was a Christian. One of my few friends, I think, who understood the first Stephen Hawking book, Brief History of Time. It's said to be the most bought and least read volume in English history. Well, one of the few friends who understands that, he's a reader at Imperial College in physics, theoretical physics. He's a committed Christian. Some of the most famous scientists of the day, so the very same year that Richard Dawkins brought out his book, The God Delusion, Francis Collins, the director then of the Human Genome Project, the project responsible for sequencing the human DNA, he published his book, The Language of God, in which he articulates his belief in a Christian God. It's certainly not the case that being a scientist necessarily compels you to be an atheist. It wasn't that way at the start of science, and it's not that way now. And I want to suggest that that points to the idea that the conflict isn't an obvious and simple one between science and Christian belief. As if automatically, as soon as you take science seriously, you have to take Jesus less seriously. That doesn't seem to match up with the facts and the convictions of many in the past and many today. But undoubtedly there is a conflict. But I want to suggest today that the conflict is not between science and Jesus, but rather between two different philosophies, two different belief systems, two different views of the world. In particular, there's a conflict between the worldview, or the belief system known as naturalism, and the worldview of the Bible. Now, naturalism is the belief that says that the cosmos is all that there is. All that there is in this universe is just matter and chance and the law of physics. In fact, if you go with Stephen Hawking, all there is in the world, at least at the beginning, was the law of gravity. That's enough for him. Carl Sagan, the cosmologist, in his recent TV programme you may have seen, he put it like this. In a parody of the Bible statement that God was and is to come, Carl Sagan says, no, the cosmos was and is to come. All there's ever been, just the cosmos, just matter and chance, just the laws of physics. Bertrand Russell, the great British philosopher, he once described mankind as a chance collocation of atoms on a minor speck of interstellar dust. Or Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, every living thing was born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance. All that we are, just randomness and the law of gravity, the laws of physics. And that view of the world, that philosophy, does conflict with the philosophy of the Bible and with the Bible's description of who we are and what we're doing here. And we heard a little bit from the Bible's description in that reading we had. I want to draw attention to it again. This is taken from a speech given by the Apostle Paul in Athens in the first century. Now, Athens was the intellectual capital of the day. It was like the first century Harvard or Oxford or somewhere like that. And people used to gather around to debate the latest ideas. And we're told in particular that Paul got speaking to some Stoic and Epicurean philosophers. I didn't know much about Stoicism or Epicureanism, but I looked it up. And apparently those philosophers believed that the gods were so remote as to have no real involvement in human affairs. Life effectively was down to chance, a random concourse of events, and there was no survival after death. So in some ways, the Epicureans and Stoics of the day were a little bit like today's naturalists. And into that framework, into that idea world, Paul speaks the Christian worldview, the Christian philosophy. And it's a very different one. The universe isn't reducible to just the theory of gravity. But at the beginning, the universe came back to a person, a powerful God who made everything. Human beings aren't random accidents of millions of years of evolution. Human beings are designed, and given, Paul says, life and breath and everything by a God who designed them to know him. And death isn't the end, as the earth expires and gradually collapses into the sun as it goes supernova. But at the end of the universe, there's a judgment day when the personal God who made everything calls everyone who's ever lived before him to give account for their lives and how they've responded to him while they've lived. Two different, very different philosophies. Now the question is science automatically on the side of the naturalists? I want to suggest not. I want to suggest that naturalism is a religious belief almost, a worldview, a belief system that people bring to their science and then shapes the science that they do. But there's nothing about science and its results and its experiments which by itself favours naturalism over Christianity. It's interesting, in a book where Richard Dawkins has such a go at religious believers for being naive, just to count the number of times in which he says in this book, "I believe," and then makes an assertion without any evidence to back it up. In fact, the same might be said even of Stephen Hawking's recent book. I'm grateful for Richard Buggs, one of the university researchers here in London, a friend from church here, for pointing out to me the article in Nature, the scientific journal, reviewing Stephen Hawking's book. And just one little phrase caught my attention. He says this, "The multiverse," which is Stephen Hawking's idea he advances there, "the multiverse is possibly the most important idea of our time and may be right, but it gives me a headache. Is it science if we cannot test it?" Here is Stephen Hawking advancing a belief, a conjecture about the nature of things. But by definition, it's not something that he has found out from any experiment. It's not something he's observed. It's something he's philosophized. It's a belief, a possible explanation. And the question is then, faced with two possible beliefs, which one is right? Is it true that the universe is reducible simply to gravity and has nothing else? Or is it true that the universe at its heart comes down to a person, a designer, who made everything? And a responsible scientific approach to that question is to ask which one of those makes most sense of the facts. Which one makes most sense of the evidence? I want to compare them in three different ways. Which one makes most sense of the world that we observe? Which one makes most sense of human life? Which one makes most sense of Jesus Christ? Which one of them makes most sense of the world that we observe? Well, it's often been said that the world that we live in looks like it was designed. It doesn't look accidental or random. Even the atheists will concede that. But according to writers like Richard Dawkins, design is just an illusion. It's a trick that the universe has played on us, that we've fallen for. So this is what Dawkins says in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, which was compulsory reading for me when I was about to go up to Cambridge. He says this, "Design," he puts it in inverted commas to show his contempt for the idea, "design is only apparent. We have a mechanism to account for it, natural selection. The blind, unconscious, automatic process, which we now know is the explanation for the existence of and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind, has no mind, no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of watchmaker in nature, it is that of the blind watchmaker," hence the title of his book. So design is just an illusion, it's a trick. It's not real. Actually, everything is accidental. But you'll see from this reading of the Apostle Paul that he says that design is actually something which we rightly observe, because the world we live in was created and put together by a personal God. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples built by hands. He's not served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all man life and breath and everything else. Now the question is, which one makes most sense of the universe? One of the big problems facing physicists is just how carefully fine-tuned the universe seems to be for life and for existence. Take, for example, the Big Bang Theory. If the universe expanded too quickly the very beginning of the Big Bang, then all you would have in the universe would be hydrogen atoms, the smallest atoms, separated by millions and millions of miles of space, a vacuum in between. Just an explosion of matter, very thinly spread, never condensing into anything bigger than hydrogen. Never, no planets, no star factories, nothing like that. On the other hand, if the universe expanded too slowly, then gravity would get the better of it, and it would collapse back on upon itself before there was even 1 second on the clock. You get a big bang and a big crunch, a universe, no universe, and before you'd even counted to one on your second hand. In order to have any kind of universe of the kind that we live in, which has got things more complicated than gas in it and lasts for longer than a second, the expansion rate of the universe has to be exactly right. It's calculated to have to be correct to within one part in 10 to the 70. So 1 in 10 with 70 noughts on the end. If you want an analogy for that kind of number, imagine covering the planet with 5 penny pieces, stacking 5 penny pieces to a depth of the distance between here and the moon. I know there's not enough metal in the world to make that many 5 pieces, but just imagine. And paint one of them red, hide it amongst all the others, blindfold your girlfriend or your boyfriend, get him to pick one at random. He gets the right one, 1 in 10 to the 70. It looks very, very unlikely. Well, Christians would say, well, of course the universe is exactly the right way because as a personal designer, he made it that way. But the fine-tuning of the universe for the atheist has been a huge problem. Until Stephen Hawking has said, with others like him, it must be that there is a multiverse, an infinite number of simultaneous universes, and we are just in the one that got lucky. So there's no point in asking the question. You know, it's like if you had a million monkeys, an infinite number of monkeys, all randomly hitting piano keys. One of them is going to play Beethoven's second piano sonata perfectly, just by accident. If you have enough monkeys doing it, enough times of throwing the dice, eventually the number's going to come out. But notice that the idea of an infinite number of simultaneous universes, it's not science. It's a belief. It's a conjecture. It's something we can't observe. But it is a faith position and a contrary one to the position that God made everything. Which one makes most sense? I must admit, I find that the kind of anthropic principle, so-called, the idea that we're only in this universe because it's the one where the numbers came out right in the dice, I do find that problematic as I begin to think about my life. You know, what would you say, I was talking to someone the other day, we came up with this, what would you say if suddenly you were looking up into the sky one day and the moon became suddenly became a face of a pig and oinked at you? Well, there's no point in being surprised. You just have to say, well, I'm presumably living in the universe where that happens. This is just the one where that goes that way. You know, everything that happens is not surprising or unusual. It's just one of the infinitely many universes where that happens. What about the universe? There's a universe, presumably, somewhere where I die halfway through this talk. Maybe you're hoping this is the one that you're living in, depending on how you're finding it. There's no point in being surprised by that. That's just the instantaneous of the multiverse where that happens. It's certainly problematic to live your life that way, but it is a possible position. Or is the universe so peculiarly designed, does the moon stay being a moon and not turn into a pig that oinks, because it was designed this way by a personal God who wanted it to be that way? That's the first question. Secondly, which one makes most sense of human existence? Now, this is not, strictly speaking, an argument of logic. This is an argument of livability or intellectual honesty. If you are a naturalist, if you believe that the universe is all that there is, can I ask whether you have the courage to live your life in consistency with that? John Gray, who's a professor of European thought at the London School of Economics, he takes naturalists to task for failing to live consistently with their convictions. This is what he says in his book Straw Dogs. The liberal societies of the West still pay lip service to and present as a basis for morality a disgusting leftover of Judeo-Christian beliefs. Man must set this error aside and accept that his or her existence is entirely accidental. He must realise that, like a gypsy, he lived on the boundary of an alien world, A world that is deaf to his music and as indifferent to his hopes as it is to his suffering and his crimes. Now, I think that is very persuasive, actually. If the world is purely reducible to the law of gravity and randomness, say, well, then that world is deaf, indifferent to hopes, suffering, crimes. It doesn't care. It's just randomness at that root. It's just impersonal. And sociology is reducible to psychology. Psychology is reducible to biology. Biology is reducible to chemistry. Chemistry is reducible to physics. Physics reduces to the law of gravity. That's all that there is. And it doesn't care. Now, just think about that in terms of living your life. What do you say to somebody whose 21-year-old son is knocked down by a bus on his bike and killed, as one of my mother's friends was? Nothing to say. It's just meaningless numbers. It's just accidental. It's just the law of gravity in many millions of years. There's nothing more that you can say than that. What do you say to somebody who murdered somebody else? I once said to one of the lecturers when I was doing my PhD, he was an atheist and often had me on the ropes with arguments I couldn't answer. But I remember one conversation where I said to her, look, Kate, if you're right about the universe, if it's just random, can you tell me why killing you would be wrong? In particular, why would it be any different to slicing in half the grapefruit that I eat for my breakfast? All I'd be doing in both cases would be rearranging the atoms of the universe in a slightly different way. Kate atoms, grapefruit atoms, increasing the entropy by a factor of 2. She thought about it for a moment. She said, if you killed me, my mother would be upset. That was a good answer. But I said to her, look, we were doing neuroscience. I said to Kate, what's upset? Upset is just the increase of the concentration of a neurotransmitter in the randomly assembled collection of atoms, which is your mother's brain. Doesn't matter. Now, I'm not saying that because naturalism is ugly, it must be false. That's not a logical argument, and I know that. But I do want to invite you, if you are a naturalist and a comfortably one, just to have the courage to examine the ground on which you stand. You see, I dismissed Christianity at university because it was inconvenient and because naturalism gave me all the freedom I wanted to live in the world exactly the way that I chose. I could dismiss Jesus, I could dismiss all the inconvenience of the worries about there being a God I would have to answer to, and just live in a very nice way. And I'm grateful for those who encouraged me to examine the foundations of my faith. Because as a naturalist, let me tell you, I live with my head in the sand. I did not live out the things that I believed about the world. I didn't live my life as though the universe was indifferent to me, as if suffering didn't matter, as if morality was an illusion, an epiphenomenon. And I'm glad I didn't, but I wasn't being consistent. What, though, is the Bible's view of human life? You can see it there in that reading we had. Look at verse 25 again. Halfway through the verse, God himself gives to all men life and breath and everything. The life that we live, the existence we have, is a gift from a personal, loving creator. And what's his intention for us? Well, we're not random and accidental with no purpose. Verse 27, his intention that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way towards him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us. Humanity has an intention, namely a relationship with the God who made us. Now, at this point, science is out of its depth. It's not that there's anything wrong with science as a system of inquiry. It can tell us many amazing things. But science cannot tell you everything. And one of the things it cannot tell you about is personal relationship. Imagine, I don't know where you're at, that some of you will be married, others of you will be single, others of you will be dating. Imagine you're going on your first date with somebody later this evening. And you want to get to know them and you want to explore the possibility of a relationship. And you decide to resort to only what you can determine from scientific experiments. What could you tell? Well, you could do some electron microscopy, I suppose, on their on the fibres on their skirt or their trousers and discover some fibres from the central line and deduce the way that they got to your date. You could take a DNA sample and analyse it and compare it with a database and see if they were related to any notorious criminals. or whether they had the propensity for any genetic diseases which might knock them off in the next 10 or 20 years. You could do gas chromatography somewhere around their armpit and discover what deodorant they use or what perfume they're wearing and whether or not it's effective. I think that's pretty much all you could tell. You wouldn't be able to tell their name. You wouldn't be able to tell what they love and what they hate, what makes them laugh, what makes them cry. You wouldn't be able to assess anything about the possibility of friendship or relationship with them. It's not that there's anything wrong with science. It's just science isn't the only tool that we need to tell us everything that's important in the world and in our lives. But much more so when we deal with the God who made everything. It's not only that science doesn't tell you about relationships in general, but how do you measure the God who's everywhere? How do you exclude him from the system in order to take a null reading as a control? How do you discover anything about his personality, his intentions, his designs? Science is limited when it comes to that. But wonderfully, the Bible says that God has taken the initiative to reveal himself in history, in the man Jesus Christ. Rather than leaving us to guess in our laboratories about the thing that is most important, God has decided to speak through the person of Jesus and through his resurrection. Just look at the very end of the reading, verse 30. The times of ignorance about God, the times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he's fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man he's appointed, and of this he's given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Or in other translations, of this he's given proof to all by raising him from the dead. Now that is a very surprising word to find in the Bible, if you believe the Richard Dawkins meta-narrative. See, Dawkins tells us that science is about evidence and it gets results. But myths and faiths are not and do not, to quote him. But notice here, the Bible is not interested in just myths and faiths in the sense of leaps in the dark. The Bible deals in what it calls proof or evidence or testimony or argument. Now, that was an enormous surprise to me when I started looking into Christianity. I was impressed by it, by the effect it had on people's lives. I wanted to know if it was true. But one thing I'd never realised before was that Christianity is a matter of historical testimony or fact. What happened in Palestine 2,000 years ago with this Jewish carpenter called Jesus that over a billion people in the world think is God? What really happened? So Christianity isn't just an idea, a collection of moral principles, a philosophy. It's not even a kind of clever theory like the multiverse or the M theory. Christianity is about the historical facts, the life of a person. And the question is, did it really happen? What really happened? Is it conceivable that this person really was the creator of the universe, stepping into time and space to reveal God to us? It seems to me if he was, well, then the question is settled. If Jesus Christ really was God the Creator visiting the planet, well, then Christianity must be true. On the other hand, if he was some clever con man who convinced naive and gullible people, then we can dismiss it and we're still searching for a theory of everything. Let me ask you then, as we close this talk, whether you are even prepared to accept the possibility that this is true. I think as a scientist, that would be the responsible thing to do. So to put your weight behind M theory or multiverse theory is essentially a faith position in the absence of any empirical evidence, and to refuse to look at alternatives, that would be a prejudiced and unscientific thing. To look at Jesus and to decide in advance that his miracles are impossible, that would be an unscientific thing to do. The scientist must observe and investigate and see where the evidence leads. Very tragically, I think the most tragic thing about this book, The God Delusion, is its failure to do that. In the whole book of how many pages? 450 odd pages. Jesus barely gets a mention. And when discussed, he's discussed with a dismissive wave of the hand and some of the weakest intellectual arguments of the book. We read, for example, that no one knows who the four gospel writers were, and they almost certainly never met Jesus personally. It's an astonishing claim and completely at variance with all historical knowledge of the early centuries, because Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, whose eyewitness testimonies of Jesus find their way into the New Testament, were named and known early in the second century. Papias in 130 AD names Matthew and Mark as two of the evangelists. Irenaeus, slightly later in the second century, names John. Historians know exactly who they were, and that their writings date from the time of Jesus. There's no good evidence, says Richard Dawkins, that Jesus believed himself to be God, which is an astonishing claim, because very early in the eyewitnesses, we discover the conflict that Jesus comes into with the Pharisees, the religious teachers of the day, for blasphemy, for claiming to do things that only God could do. Richard Dawkins dismisses the evidence of Jesus with the contempt of someone who's already decided what they believe before they look at the evidence. So it's a very ironic thing to do, given his charge at Christians. I would urge you, if you're open-minded enough, scientific enough to decide, to look at the evidence objectively. For example, why not take the time to read one of the eyewitnesses about Jesus for yourself? One of the contemporary accounts written by people at the time. See, what was it about Jesus that convinced them? Well, for example, were they just scientifically gullible? I used to think that. You know, I thought, well, you know, nowadays we know that miracles are impossible, but then they were quite credulous and they probably didn't realise it's impossible to walk on water unless it's frozen. They probably didn't realise the conservation of matter, and so the feeding of the 5,000 didn't really puzzle them. And you know, you don't have to be that scientifically sophisticated to understand that dead people are dead. I understood that pretty well, because they'd seen people die lots of times. And when they encountered a dead person that they'd seen be executed, rise from the dead, when they met him and touched him and confirmed it was the same person as they saw the wounds where he'd been executed, well, then they thought, we better revise our theory. Obviously, there is a God. There must be an author of life who can raise from the dead. There must be a creator who made us and designed us. It must be right to turn back to him and put him at the centre of our lives. If you like, a Copernican revolution. I want to suggest that is a matter of evidence. The Bible is not asking anyone here to throw away their minds and put their trust in something. In fact, it's asking us to trust something on the basis of testimony, on the basis of a revelation that God has made of himself in the person of Jesus Christ. And I would urge you just to take the time to look into it. On the tables, there are little Luke's Gospels and little green things with the kind of heart cardiogram on them. Won't take you very long to read, but just to make a reasoned decision about Jesus on the basis of the facts. And then ask yourself, do I want to follow the Christian theory? Or do I want to follow the Richard Dawkins or the Stephen Hawking one? Thank you for listening. I'm going to hand over to David. He's going to introduce what happens next.
Really engaging. Lots of questions to think about. Looking at the time, I think we haven't got time to take questions publicly. But can I ask you to stick at the front here? And if people have questions, to come and find you when we've finished. I'm really sorry that we've run short of time. Can I suggest two particular ways for investigating further, as Andrew was encouraging us to do? We meet in here every Tuesday and Thursday lunchtime. You'll find flyers for our current series on the tables, Broken Britain. We're looking at the early chapters of Genesis, seeing what the real problem is with the world. Every Tuesday and Thursday lunchtime in here. Details are on the flyers. So if you're interested in hearing more, that might be something you're interested in. Also, we run something called Christianity Explored. It's a chance over six lunchtimes to look further into the claims of Jesus. We take Mark's Gospel and work through that over six lunchtimes. There's a talk and then a chance for questions and discussions around the tables. Can I commend that to you very, very strongly? Hundreds of people have done that over the years in the city. Lots of people I can see around this room have found it a really, really helpful thing to do. The next course starts on the 3rd of November, which is very soon. If you might be interested in that, please do jot your details down on the sheet, or there's a form on the tables, and either hand that to me, or there's something on the way out to pop that into on the welcome desk. But that's a fantastic way of looking further into the claims of Christianity. Thank you very much indeed for coming. It's a wonderful thing to have lots of guests with us. We hope you've really enjoyed your time here, and we hope that we'll see you back here again soon. Thank you very much.